The wrong door, the right storm. Her grandmother used to say, a candle does not choose which dark room it enters. It only chooses whether to burn. Maren Voss had heard that saying so many times it had worn grooves into her memory, the way river water carves stone. She'd heard it the morning her wolf failed to emerge at her first shift ceremony, leaving her standing in a moonlit clearing, while every other 16-year-old in Ashvale howled their new nature to the sky. She'd heard it the day her mother packed a small bag and didn't come back. She'd heard it the night her grandmother pressed a single brass button into her palm, the last button from her dead grandfather's army coat, warm from the old woman's pocket, and whispered it one final time before she closed her eyes forever. A candle does not choose which dark room it enters. It only chooses whether to burn. Maren was 23 years old, wolfless, nearly penniless, and hopelessly lost in the worst storm the Kaervest Mountains had produced in 40 years, when she discovered that her grandmother had been right about almost everything. Almost, because some doors, it turns out, are not the wrong ones at all. Chapter 1. The Storm and the Stranger's Road. The road had a name on Maren's crumpled letter of employment, Thornfield Lane, leading to Thornfield Manor, where a Lord Davin of the East March needed a seasonal bookkeeper for his estate records. 27 copper marks for 8 weeks of work, enough to see her through the winter. But the storm had swallowed the signpost whole. She'd left the last village, Kettwick, 3 hours ago on foot, because she couldn't afford the hired cart that the innkeeper's son had offered, with a smirk that told her the price would be renegotiated mid-journey. She carried everything she owned, a canvas satchel, a change of clothes, a ledger of her own grandmother's careful accounting that she'd taught herself from, and the brass button in her coat pocket, where she always kept it. The rain was not rain anymore. It was a living thing, horizontal and furious, tearing at the pine trees lining both sides of the road until they bent like penitents. Lightning illuminated the mountain in white stutters. In one such flash, Maren saw a fork she hadn't expected, and the signpost at its center snapped at the base, lying face down in the mud. She stood there for a moment, the storm screaming around her, water streaming down the back of her neck. She could go left or right. Both roads curved into darkness equally. Left, she decided, for no better reason than it felt slightly downhill, and surely an estate would sit in a valley. She was wrong. But she wouldn't know that for another hour. The gates, when she finally found them, were iron. Black, baroque, worked into the shapes of wolves mid-leap, frozen in eternal charge. They stood open, which she took as a welcome sign. A gravel drive curved up through stands of dead-fingered oaks toward a house so large it appeared to consume the sky behind it. Every window was dark except one on the second floor, burning amber like a single eye. Maren walked up the drive, drenched to her spine, her boots making sounds like small drownings with each step. She climbed the front steps, lifted the iron knocker, also a wolf, its mouth agape, and knocked 3 times. The door opened almost immediately, which surprised her. A man stood in the doorway. Not a butler, not a footman. He was tall enough to reduce the doorframe to a suggestion, with shoulders that the doorway accommodated only just. His hair was dark and rain-damp, even though he'd been inside, and his eyes were the particular gray of iron left out in weather. Not silver, not blue, something hammered and functional and quietly dangerous. He wore no jacket. The sleeves of his white shirt were rolled to the elbow. He held a glass of something amber. He looked at her the way people looked at things they hadn't ordered and weren't sure what to do with. "I am so sorry," Maren said, and she was genuinely, thoroughly sorry, rain running from her eyelashes as she spoke. "I believe I've come to the wrong house. I was looking for Thornfield Manor, and I think I took the wrong road at the broken signpost." She paused. "Could you possibly tell me where I am?" A long silence. The amber eye in the second floor window seemed to watch over his shoulder. "You're at Kaervest Hall," he said. His voice was low, a sound that belonged in the register of stone and old timber. "And Thornfield Manor is 4 miles east." He looked past her at the storm, which chose that moment to clap a particularly violent peal of thunder. You walked here. I did. In this. Also, yes. He looked at her for another moment. She could feel him cataloging her, not unkindly, but thoroughly, the way a man accustomed to making fast assessments did it without meaning to show it. Wolfless, she knew. She had no scent of pack or shift, just wet wool and determination. Come inside, he said, and stepped back. Chapter 2. Kervast Hall and its Master. His name was Aldrich Kervast. She learned this not from him, but from the housekeeper, Dame Sorley, a small woman of 60 with the posture of a bayonet, who materialized from the back of the house within minutes of Marin's entrance, and immediately took charge of her with efficient, unsentimental kindness. Dry clothes, hot soup, a fire in a small sitting room off the kitchen while her own things steamed on a rack nearby. He doesn't usually let people in, Sorley said quietly, setting the soup down. She said it as if this was information Marin needed, without explaining why. I won't be any trouble, Marin said. I just need to wait out the worst of it. That's not what I meant. Sorley studied her for a moment with dark, pragmatic eyes. I meant you should understand that it isn't nothing. That he opened the door. The soup was extraordinary. A deep venison broth with herbs Marin couldn't name. She ate the whole bowl and tried not to think about what Sorley meant. Later, when she felt human again, she explored the sitting room with the particular hunger of someone who has grown up loving books and being denied them. The shelves here held ledgers. Dozens of them. She pulled one out without thinking, the way a person reaches for water. It was an estate record. Crops, tenants, trade accounts. The handwriting was different in places, as if it had passed through several hands. The most recent entries were in a cramped, reluctant script, full of crossing outs. The numbers didn't balance. She found 3 errors in 2 pages without trying. Those are private, she spun. Aldrich Kervast stood in the doorway. He'd put a jacket on, dark wool, but he still looked like a man wearing an outfit rather than inhabiting one, as if his real nature was something less formal. I apologize. She held the ledger out. I should have asked. I'm a bookkeeper by trade. I can't help reading numbers the way some people can't help. She stopped. I'll put it back. He didn't move from the doorway. You said bookkeeper. Seasonal. I was going to Thornfield Manor. She gestured vaguely at the storm, still audible through the walls. His gaze went to the open ledger, still in her extended hand. Show me what you found. She blinked. He wasn't asking, but he wasn't unkind about it either. She turned to the page. Here. The grain tallies for last autumn have been transposed. Someone wrote 340 where they meant 430. And then this column builds on that error, so everything downstream is wrong by 90 units. If this affects your tax records, she turned another page. And it does. He crossed the room slowly and looked where she pointed. Up close, he smelled of wood smoke and cold stone and something darker underneath. Something like petrichor before lightning, which her wolfless instincts couldn't name, but her body registered without her permission. Voss, she said somewhat abruptly. My name, Marin Voss. I should have said when you let me in. I know. At her look, Sorley told me. He straightened. Outside, the storm made a sound like the sky coming apart at a seam. You can't travel in this. I'll leave at first light. You'll stay tonight. There are rooms. He said it with the economy of a man who'd made a decision and saw no reason to dress it up with social niceties. He took the ledger, looked at the errors one more time, and set it down on the small table. The rest of them are in the study. If you find yourself awake and inclined. He left. Marin sat for a moment with the brass button pressed between her thumb and forefinger, the way she did when she needed to think. A candle does not choose which dark room it enters. The study, she thought, was definitely going to be a dark room. Chapter 3. What the Ledgers Said About a Man. She was there by midnight. The study was a cathedral of neglect, high-ceilinged, wood-paneled, magnificent in the way of things that had once been cared for, and now existed in a state of dignified abandonment. Books everywhere, many lying open as if abandoned mid-thought. Maps on one wall, a cold fireplace, on the massive oak desk, 17 ledgers in a precarious stack, several losing the battle with gravity. Marin lit the lamp she'd carried from the sitting room and got to work. Numbers told stories if you knew how to listen. The Kyrvast estate had been prosperous, genuinely, significantly prosperous, until about 5 years ago. Then something had changed. Income continued, but reinvestment stopped. Maintenance records vanished. The tenant accounts showed an estate manager, one Halveth, who'd been systematically skimming funds in small enough amounts to pass casual inspection for at least 3 years, leaving the numbers in a state of confused dysfunction that probably looked, to an untrained eye, like simple disorganization. There was something else in the ledgers, too, in the gaps and silences. No entries in a particular week, every year in late autumn. No household accounts during that week. No staff wages. Nothing. Just blankness on the page, as if whoever had kept the books that week had agreed collectively not to look. And 5 years ago, a name recurring in the social accounts, hosting records, correspondence costs, gift expenditures, Lady Vesna. And then, nothing. A hard stop, like a word cut from a sentence with a blade. Marin was not the kind of person who leaped to conclusions, but numbers were narratives. 5 years of a man pulling back from the world had a shape, and its shape was grief. She worked until the lamp grew low. She had organized 3 years of records, corrected the transposition errors and their cascading effects, cross-referenced the tenant payments against the missing manager funds, and drafted a concise summary on the back of a blank ledger page she found tucked in the back of the stack. In the morning, she would leave. She would leave the summary, because it was the right thing to do, and she would walk the 4 miles to Thornfield Manor, and that would be the end of the wrong road. She almost believed it. Chapter 4. The Morning and the Offer. Kyrvast Hall looked different in pale winter light. Less consuming, more wounded. The bones of it were extraordinary. The proportions of the rooms, the quality of the stone, the carved details above each doorway. Someone had loved this house very much. It showed in the loving, and it showed in the stopping. Marin found Aldrich Kyrvast in the kitchen before Sorley arrived, which she suspected was unusual. He was making coffee with the focused intensity of a man who had recently decided that this, at least, he could control. He was wearing the look of a man who had not slept. She set her summary on the table beside his cup. He looked at it without touching it. You worked through the night. Most of it. There's a ledger summary there. Your estate manager has been defrauding you for 3 years. The figures are outlined. You should take it to your PAC's legal counsel. She picked up her dried satchel from the rack by the door. The storm's passed. I should go. How much? She turned back. He was looking at the summary now, and his expression had done something complicated. Not shock, more like a man recognizing the outline of something he'd suspected, but refused to examine. How much did Halveth take? He repeated. The conservative estimate is in the summary. Nearly 400 gold marks over 3 years. She watched him absorb that. The actual total could be higher. I only had access to the secondary accounts. If he had access to the primary accounts are in the locked cabinet. He set the summary down and looked at her directly, the gray gaze landing with a weight that had nothing of rudeness in it, but everything of precision. You're going to Thornfield Manor to keep books for Davin. For 8 weeks, yes. I'll pay 12 marks a week, he said. 16 if you solve Halveth and prepare the legal case, for as long as it takes. Marin stood very still. 12 marks a week was nearly triple what she'd negotiated at Thornfield. She was not a fool. She also was not unaware of the reasons a woman might be offered a large sum to stay in a large, remote house with a man she'd met last night. She'd navigated that particular negotiation before. She looked at him clearly. I want to understand the terms. He met her gaze without flinching. Books, legal preparation. Tenant accounts restructured for the spring. Nothing else is being offered or expected. Sorley runs this house and will confirm that to anyone you need to hear it from. You'll have your own rooms, a key, and the right to leave whenever you choose. She believed him. Not because he was handsome and she wanted to, but because he'd said nothing else is being offered or expected in the same tone he used for everything else. Flat, declarative, not performing. She thought about the brass button in her pocket. Her grandmother's voice. A candle does not choose which dark room it enters. All right, she said. But I need to send a letter to Thornfield first. I won't leave Lord Davin without notice. The ghost of something, not quite a smile, but its distant ancestor, crossed Aldrich Kervast's face. Sorely we'll see it goes with the Morning Rider. Chapter 5. What thaws? Slowly. The first week was formal. Maren worked. Aldrich stayed out of her way, which she found professionally ideal and personally curious. He was running an estate, clearly, but he was doing it with the minimum of contact. Servants kept their own routines, tenants submitted their complaints in writing rather than being heard, and Aldrich himself moved through the hall like a man trying to take up as little space as possible. Sorley, who had appointed herself Marin's unofficial guide to the geography of Kyrvast, explained it in pieces over evening tea. He wasn't always like this, she said one evening as the fire cracked and settled. Before Vesna, I saw the name in the accounts. His mate. Sorley said it simply, without ceremony. Fated. They had 3 months together before a riding accident took her. He was 26. A pause, a long one. He blamed himself. He'd chosen the horses. He'd built the trail. She looked into her cup. The pack needed their Alpha King present. He gave them what they needed. The decisions. The strength. The protection. But he stopped being anywhere anyone could reach him. Marin thought about the week of blank ledger pages every autumn. She didn't ask. Some silences were their own kind of answer. The second week, Aldrich began coming to the study in the evenings. He didn't interrupt her. He would take a book from the shelf and sit on the opposite side of the fire, reading or not reading, present in a way that felt, to Marin's perceptions, like a man practicing something he'd forgotten. She said nothing about it, only kept working, and the silence between them was not empty. On the eighth day, she found an error in the primary accounts, a significant one, not Halveth's doing, but a structural problem with how the estate had been calculating land use tax for 11 years, resulting in significant overpayment that could be reclaimed. She'd been excited about it in the particular private way she got excited about numbers, and she made the mistake of saying his name, Aldrich, before she remembered herself. He looked up from his book. Sorry, she said. Lord Kervast, I found something. You called me Aldrich, he said, not like an accusation, like something he was processing. I didn't mean to overstep. No one has used my name like that in... He stopped, looked at the fire. What did you find? She told him. He listened the way she'd noticed he listened, completely, not waiting for his turn to speak. Actually absorbing. When she finished, he said, how much could be reclaimed? With a proper appeal over 2,000 marks. A silence. Then, very quietly, my father started that miscalculation. He never knew. Something shifted in his face. Show me. She showed him. Their heads were close over the ledger. She could feel the presence of him the way you feel weather approaching. Not threatening, but large, and real, and consequential. He said, you're extraordinary at this. It was said with complete simplicity, the way he said everything. No flourish, no performance. She felt it land in a place inside her that had grown a hard shell to protect itself, and the shell cracked slightly. Numbers don't lie to me, she said. People often do. I find numbers restful. He looked at her, and she thought perhaps he was understanding something. Is that why you chose this work? I chose it because I have no pack, no wolf, and no family money. I chose it because I'm good at it, and it asks nothing of me that I can't give. She'd never said that so plainly to anyone. She wasn't sure why she said it now. Wolfless, he said. Not as a dismissal or a surprise, more like a fact being acknowledged. You knew. I smelled it when you came to the door. I didn't care then. I don't now. He turned back to the ledger. What's the procedure for a tax reclamation appeal? And they worked side by side until the hall clock struck 11. Chapter 6. The Week of Blank Pages. The last week of October came with bronze leaves and cold smoke. Marin had been at Kervast Hall for 5 weeks, and she'd stopped counting the days until she left. On the 31st of October, Aldrich didn't come to dinner. Sorley set a plate aside and said nothing, and Marin asked nothing, because she'd remembered what the blank ledger pages meant. But she sat awake past midnight, and at half past she heard him. Not a sound exactly, but a presence moving through the house toward the eastern garden. She watched from the study window and saw him in the moonless dark, standing still in the dead garden with his head bowed. He stood there for a very long time. She did not go to him. It wasn't her place. She turned back to the fire. But she took a candle from the study, carried it to the small window seat in the hall that faced east, and let it burn there, visible through the glass. A small, stupid gesture. She wasn't sure what she meant by it. In the morning, he came to breakfast and found her already there, and he looked at her for a moment with the expression of a man who had seen something in the dark that he was still translating. "The candle," he said. "I wasn't sure if it was appropriate. I just thought perhaps a light." He sat down. He poured coffee with careful hands. "It was appropriate," he said, in a voice that had something raw in it, carefully maintained. "Thank you." They ate in silence, but it was a different kind of silence now. Something had been acknowledged without being examined, and they both left it alone with the respect it deserved. That afternoon, he took her walking on the estate, the first time he'd suggested anything outside the house. He showed her the tenant farms, the timber stands, the boundaries of the land, explaining each with the particular love a person shows for something they've kept themselves from loving openly. She listened and asked questions, and he answered all of them. And somewhere on the walk back, she realized he was telling her about the estate, the way a person introduces someone to another person they care about. When they returned to the hall, the light was the last orange of evening. He stopped at the door. "Marin?" She looked up. He was looking at her with those hammered gray eyes, the weight of them present and uncomplicated. "I want to say something plainly, because I don't know how to be indirect about important things." A pause, the kind a careful man takes. "Something is happening that I didn't expect and haven't felt in 5 years, and I don't know what you make of it. But I'd rather ask plainly than have you leave without knowing you were seen." Another pause. "Fully. Clearly. Not despite anything. As exactly what you are." Marin stood in the amber evening and understood what it meant to be looked at that way. Not categorized, not measured against a standard she couldn't meet, not managed or overlooked or found wanting. Just seen. "I don't know what I make of it either," she said honestly, "but I'm not frightened of it." He nodded once, very carefully, as if her answer was something he planned to treat with great care. Chapter 7. The Challenge and the Truth of Worth. It arrived on the sixth week like bad weather. 3 men on horseback, announced by Sorley with a look that said she'd been expecting trouble eventually. Pack elders, Lord Casson, Elder Draven, and a sharp-faced woman named Prevost, riding in from the Kervast pack territories to see about rumors. The Alpha King was keeping a wolfless woman in his house. The Alpha King had not attended the autumn summit. The Alpha King was in Casson's precise and cutting phrasing when he found Marin in the study, being led by instinct that any sensible wolf would recognize as grief-confused. Marin stood very still and let the words land without showing where they landed. "You're the girl," Prevost said, studying her with clinical interest. "Wolfless, no pack, no family standing. What exactly is your claim here?" "I'm a bookkeeper," Marin said. "I have no claim. I was hired to restore the estate accounts." "You've been here 6 weeks." "The estate was in considerable disorder." She kept her voice level. "I can show you the records if you'd like to understand the scope of the work." Cassin looked at her with the flat authority of a man who was accustomed to the view from above. This isn't about books, girl. This is about the future of the Kervas Pack. Their alpha king requires a mate of standing, a wolf of strong bloodline, someone who can... That's enough. Aldrich had come in quietly from the hall. Quiet for a man his size was a relative term, but he'd done it. He stood in the doorway, and the room reoriented itself around him the way rooms did around alpha kings, reluctantly and completely. Marin. He said it gently. Would you give us the room? She went. She sat in the small sitting room where she'd first woken warm and dry, and she pressed the brass button hard into her palm and breathed steadily. She could hear the register of voices through the wall, though not the words, Aldrich's low and certain, Cassine's initially aggressive, and then something else, something that told her of a pressure being exerted. Sorley materialized beside her and sat without ceremony. They waited together. After 20 minutes, the voices stilled. After 25, Aldrich came to the doorway of the sitting room. His jaw was set. His eyes were clear. They've suggested I have 2 weeks to make a decision, he said. The Pack has historically deferred to the Alpha King on matters of mate selection, but they're threatening a formal challenge of leadership if I... He stopped. Started again. If I pursue this. Then you shouldn't pursue it, Marin said immediately. Aldrich, you're the Alpha King. Your Pack needs you. I won't be the reason... Stop. He crossed the room and crouched down to her seated level, making himself deliberately smaller in the way of a man who knows his own size and what it means. I need to tell you something that I should have said weeks ago. He was very steady. The mate bond. What we have. What's been building. It's real. Not grief confused. I've had grief for 5 years and I know exactly what it feels like, and this is different. You are different, Marin. Not in spite of having no wolf. Not despite your background. His voice was careful and complete, the way he was careful and complete with everything that mattered to him. Cassin thinks wolfless means worthless. I want you to know that I think he is the lesser man for it. She looked at him. There were about 6 things happening in her chest simultaneously, and she was managing all of them with the iron composure she'd developed over 23 years of being told she was insufficient, and it was only barely working. What did you say to them? She asked. I said the Alpha King of Kervast will make his own decisions, and any elder who brings pack law against a woman's basic dignity will find their land grants reviewed. A pause. And then I asked them to leave. They left. Sorley, who had been present and silent, made a small sound that was, Marin strongly suspected, the closest thing to approval the woman had ever expressed. Chapter 8. What Burns. She almost left anyway. Not because of the elders. She understood political pressure, and she didn't fear it on her own behalf. She almost left because she was not built for being important to anyone, had not been built for it, had spent years making herself small and useful and self-contained, and she was not sure she knew how to stop. She stood in her rooms with her packed satchel for 20 minutes before she understood that she was being asked, for the first time in her life, not to make herself smaller so someone else could be comfortable. She was being asked to be exactly as large as she actually was. She put the satchel down. She went to the study, where Aldrich was sitting, not with a book, just sitting, as if waiting for an outcome he'd already made peace with. And she sat across the fire from him and said, I'm not leaving. He looked at her. I'm not leaving, she repeated. But I want to say something that I've never said out loud to anyone, because I've always protected myself with not saying it. She held the brass button between her fingers and spoke to the fire. My whole life I have been the wrong kind. No wolf, no pack, no family worth mentioning. Every room I've walked into, I've known there's someone taking a measurement. And I've gotten very good at being good at my work, which is its own sort of protection, because it's harder to dismiss someone who's just corrected your accounts by 2,000 marks. She looked at him. But I have never once walked into a room where I felt like I was enough before the proof. Until here. Until you. He said nothing. He simply came around the fire and sat beside her and covered her hand, the brass button and all, with his own. It wasn't a claiming. It wasn't grand. It was the gesture of a man who understood that something had been trusted to him, and he was accepting the trust with appropriate gravity. Later, the fire burned low. She told him about the button, her grandmother, the saying. He told her about Vesna, simply, clearly, the way he told all important things. And he said it hurt. And he said it was real. And he said that grief and joy were not enemies. They were seasons, and he had been stuck in one season for 5 years, and he was not stuck anymore. She stayed. Outside, the first snow of winter began to fall on Kervast Hall, soft and without violence, covering the old wounds of the garden in clean white. A candle does not choose which dark room it enters. It only chooses whether to burn. Maren Voss chose to burn. Epilogue. 1 year later. The autumn summit was held at Kervast Hall. Aldrich had arranged it. In the past year, Halveth had faced Packlaw proceedings, and the recovered funds had been returned to the defrauded tenants. The tax reclamation had come through, 2,300 marks, which had funded new roofing on the tenant farms, and a library in Ketwick that Marin may have suggested and Aldrich had funded without discussion. The dead garden behind the hall was not dead anymore. Someone had planted bulbs in November with cold, deliberate hands, and they had come up in spring in extraordinary colors. Elder Casson had not formally challenged the Alpha King. He had, however, been conspicuously absent from 2 pack councils, which sorely considered a victory, and reported on with something approaching delight. Maren stood at the top of the eastern staircase in the hall and watched the guests arrive for the summit dinner. She was wearing a gown the color of deep water, which she was still not entirely accustomed to, and her hair was up in a way she'd learned from Sorley and still considered a small daily miracle. She was the Alpha Queen of Kervast. She still had no wolf. The ceremony, Aldrich's ceremony, his pack kneeling to the sun, had included her, wolfless, standing exactly as she was. Aldrich had said to his pack simply that a wolf is not what a person is. It is one thing a person might have. Maren Voss has everything that matters. He had said it in the same flat, declarative tone he used for all important things, and the pack had been quiet, and then a few had nodded, and then more, because truth had a weight that even stubborn people eventually felt. She was not beloved by all of them. She was respected by most, and that was enough, and she'd decided it was enough, which was its own kind of power. Aldrich appeared at the bottom of the staircase and looked up at her. The gray eyes found her across the distance with the same deliberate precision they'd used on the night she'd arrived, soaked and apologizing at the wrong door in the worst storm in 40 years. He offered his hand as she descended. "Ready?" he said. "I came to the wrong house in a thunderstorm," she said, taking his hand. "I've recalibrated my standard for ready." The ghost of a smile had, in 12 months, become an actual smile, not frequent, but real, which made it worth more. He used it now, in her free hand tucked into the small inner pocket of the gown's wrist seam, where she'd asked the seamstress to stitch a pocket just large enough, was her grandmother's brass button, warm from her skin. A candle does not choose which dark room it enters. It only chooses whether to burn. She had not chosen this room. She had chosen to burn in it. And the room, this old, cold, magnificent, wounded room, had filled with light. She walked into the summit with her head high and her husband's hand in hers, and somewhere in the back of the gathering, a young, wolfless woman stood against the wall with the expression of a person expecting to be dismissed, and Maren saw her, because she had always been able to see that particular person from across any room. She caught the girl's eye and held it, and she smiled. "You are enough before the proof," her eyes said. "Come in from the storm." The brass button sat warm against her wrist. Her grandmother, she thought, would have